Tito Naranjo and Tim Coulter both had to leave last night, so they will not be with us today. Joe Jorgensen, I think, expected to be with us, but he had sudden news of an illness in the family, and I hope he does come today so that we can thank him for leading off the discussion with his paper and to express the hope that nothing serious has occurred to any member of his family. Sheldon Kachetag, who is Vice President of the United Tribes of Alaska, has joined us this morning, and we welcome him and invite him to participate. I said yesterday that we would invite Daley Sambo and Alfred Starr to lead off the discussion this morning, if either wishes to. Daley, do you want to begin?
Yes, please. I work for the Inuit Circumpolar Conference at the Alaska Regional Office here, but throughout these comments that I'll make this morning, they in no way reflect what the ICC's feelings or positions or policy is with regard to ANCSA, and hopefully at a later date and time, the ICC will come out with a formal statement to the Commission and can make that either orally or in writing. I'm an Inupiaq. My parents are from Unalakleet. They were born and raised there. I was born and raised here in Anchorage and have somewhat of an understanding of Indian law. I hold a tribal court advocate certificate and a paralegal certificate. I wanted just to, before I got into some of the issues that I wanted to see come out in this roundtable discussion, just make note of two things that were mentioned over the past couple of days. Mr. Lerner and also Tito Naranjo made mention to, or Mr. Lerner stated that a good number of Indian people are betwixt in between, and Mr. Naranjo said it in the way that the one foot in two worlds. And this may be true for a great number of Indian people as well as a great number of Inuit throughout Alaska, Canada, and Greenland, but I think we should keep in mind that we may be betwixt in between, we may have one foot in two worlds, but we do so with one spirit. There was also a point made by Mr. Lerner about discrimination, and I think that Tim Coulter was trying to respond in that the point that Mr. Lerner made was that there was discrimination, he used both words, discrimination and favoritism, by allowing those people of one quarter blood or more to be enrolled to a tribe and to receive special privileges, or I can't remember exactly the word, but I think that the point that Tim Coulter was trying to make in response to that point was that there's discrimination in the other direction also, like the non-application of the Fifth Amendment to Indian people. That's a discrimination. And over dinner, we were discussing this the other night, and Charlie Edwardson made the comment that he spent $10 million to find out that the Fifth Amendment did not apply to him, and that's discrimination in the other direction. I think that some of the things that have been said here in regards to possible alternatives, and Mr. Johnson discussed municipalities and IRAs and Public Law 280, I kind of wanted to expand upon some of these things. I think that he is right to say that it's going to take a more comprehensive and more intensive type of work to develop some of these possibilities or alternatives or accommodations that could be applicable here in Alaska, and I certainly look forward to that type of work, whether it's done through this commission or through the interests and concerns of people like Mr. Johnson and other legally qualified people as well as lay people here in Alaska and other areas. I think that we can all generally agree that ANCSA was a land settlement, and only a land settlement, and not a jurisdictional settlement. I'm wondering what the possibilities are in terms of a jurisdictional accommodation or an alternative jurisdictional settlement for Alaska Native people. And also, have there been land settlements in the past that did not address a governing body or political institution, or did not address a jurisdictional settlement? Have there been settlements like this in the past and throughout the lower 48? And what, if there have been, what were the ways in which the people chose to settle the lack of a jurisdictional settlement, or how did they choose to create a governing body for themselves on the land that they received under a land settlement? ANCSA, being only a land settlement here in Alaska, has created quite a number of problems, and we do have quite a bit of overlapping, like Mr. Johnson stated the other day. Yes, through ANCSA, the resources and the control of the land was left to the regional and village corporations, but still, there again, it left out any address to the jurisdictional question here. Those corporations are obviously not governments, and they never will be governments, so that lack of a jurisdictional accommodation is still there. And I think that the proof of the movement of the United Tribes of Alaska and IRAs and other traditional governments here in Alaska just shows that there is a need for some type of jurisdictional accommodation here. And I'm wondering, what are the possibilities here in terms of a governing structure and the alternatives to Alaska Natives to meet this need here? In Alaska, we have ANCSA, we have Public Law 280, which I feel applies only to private property and private or personal rights of individual people, personal and private rights. They don't apply to the traditional Native villages, the IRAs, the Native allotments, reservations, or restricted lands held in trust by the U.S. for Alaska Native people. Nor do, under Public Law 280, nor do the laws of the state of Alaska in declaring or implementing the state's power or the state sovereignty apply to the institutions that I've just mentioned, such as the power to tax. And also, we have the IRA governments. And even furthermore, we have the municipalities. And Ada Deer had mentioned the other day the situation in the Menominee Reservation, or within the Menominee Nation. The municipality, or excuse me, the tribal legislature and the county government. And I assume that the tribal legislature is federally chartered and the county government is state chartered. Well, here in Alaska, we have something very similar to that situation in that the municipalities throughout rural Alaska are state chartered and the IRA governments are federally chartered. So we have a duplication of, or an overlapping jurisdiction. And I'm wondering, and that was why I posed the question the other day about what is the distribution of jurisdiction and why is it beneficial to have both a municipality and a tribal government? And it would seem to me that there is quite an overlapping there or a duplication of services, and and that's why I was so curious about the division of or distribution of jurisdiction. Or is it that you have both and both institutions can receive benefits from varying different places, and that the only difference is that the tribal government has the inherent power of sovereignty to govern themselves, and the county or municipal governments are given that power by the states, and that may be the only difference. So I'm the other, to follow up on that, what is the best accommodation for those people? And like Al Guzmer mentioned the other day, the village of Akiachuk, who has just dissolved their municipal government and disbanded it, dissolved it, and turned over the assets and the land holdings and whatnot to the IRA government. Is it necessary to do that throughout to settle the question of a jurisdictional type, or can they both work cooperatively, or what's the benefit of that? And then there was discussion about the North Slope Borough, and Mr. Johnson talked about municipalities also, and that may be a possibility here, but there is that fear that at some point in time, like the North Slope Borough, the Inuit people are a majority there. The mayor is an Inuit. The assembly they're Inuit. However, they provide services to all residents in the North Slope Borough. They don't distinguish between a native person and a non-native person. Both have the right to vote within the North Slope Borough. But there is still that fear that the majority may shift and the control may be lost to non-natives. The assembly may be lopsided and be the majority of a majority of non-native people. So there's that fear as well within a municipal type government, and would not ensure an accommodation specifically for the native population and the concerns of native people and native people only. I think that, and we heard through the outline of Ann Finup-Reardon's paper last week and through some of the discussion of the first 3 days of last week in terms of the aspirations of the Alaska Native people. I don't think that those aspirations or those visions or those dreams have really changed that much, as expressed through the testimony in 1968 and 1969, and I think that will probably be expressed throughout the village hearings and meetings that will be held by the commission. I think that those feelings are all the same in Alaska. The need for retention of the land, the preservation and the protection of the land and the resources. And I also think that ANCSA in Village Alaska and at the village level has not had a significant impact. And I think that those were some of the statements that came across in the two village hearings at Amonok and Tununuk, that it hasn't put food on their table. It hasn't impacted them that greatly. However, it will, and I think that its biggest impact will be 1991 and the issues that surround 1991. Those will be the biggest and the most devastating impact that ANCSA will leave with the Native people. It'll be the most severe impact. The 1991 issues of stock alienation, taxation, alienation of the land 20 years after the date of conveyance, and so on. And all of that is generating a real fear that we're going to lose all of the benefits that we've received under ANCSA, and that'll be its biggest impact. I mean, loss of those benefits, loss of that control. And it is an emergency situation, like Mr. Gottschalk said yesterday. I think that it is an emergency situation that we do have to develop some alternatives. We have to do this and do it as quickly as possible, and begin some of this comprehensive and intensive legal work as to what accommodations can be found. The statements that Tim Coulter made in his initial presentation, I very much appreciate and endorse the statements that he made regarding the plenary power doctrine, the power of Congress to extinguish the Fifth Amendment and its non-application to Indian people, and the need for some basic and fundamental changes in the policies of the United States government towards Native people and Indian people throughout the U.S. And it may seem to be impractical, but that really is the crux of our problems, I think, and that's the crux of the problem here for ANCSA as well as for other Indian tribes future negotiations, that if they're always going to be taken from this base, that Congress has the power to do whatever it wants to do with Indian people. If some of those basic and underlying problems are not changed, then we'll always be working from the short end of the stick. I think that in the long run that we need to point this out. We need to assert this, that we feel that they are wrong. But that still leaves us with the immediate issues and concerns that need to be addressed. And it's already been mentioned here, but I think that, again, the best way to do it is to go to the people in urban and rural Alaska, find out, you know, on a grassroots level what it is that they want. Once we've determined what it is that they want, look at it legally and look at all the possibilities in the legal context as to how do we accommodate their needs and with an understanding of the reasons why they want those things, and try to devise a vehicle in which they can we can satisfy the needs. After this type of work is done, I mean, and after finding out what it is that the people want, what is the legal vehicle for that, take all of that work and assert that this is what is wanted by the Native people, but make this claim on the basis that from the beginning and throughout its history, the U.S. plenary power doctrine is wrong, and the power of the United States to extinguish your Aboriginal right and title and terminate you, or the eventual termination, as a compromise for a land settlement is wrong. Assert these things and not, again, just ask for another handout, like Tim had mentioned. But to do all of this work in the framework of, or at simultaneously asserting that these initial and fundamental problems and underlying problems are wrong. In the meantime, of course, all of this discussion about the feasible alternatives for a jurisdictional settlement have to take place. This may be out of line, but maybe we should, you know, declare that we're ready to negotiate for a jurisdictional settlement and call for a full-fledged restoration of our right and title. Start from the bottom, like the Menominees did. Call for full restoration of right and title within the context that this plenary power doctrine is wrong, the power to extinguish us, the power to do whatever they want to do with us is wrong. Then again, there's a more practical side of it. You know, what are the alternatives with respect to our land settlement, ANCSA? Are there possible solutions that could apply only to the regional corporations, and another set of solutions that could apply to the village corporations? And this morning I was talking to someone, maybe this whole question of stock alienation, maybe we should just get rid of stocks, you know, and make everybody an equal member in the corporation. And also the issue of afterborns. first get rid of the stock, let everybody become a member, whether they were born before 1971 or after 1991 or whichever. Allow everyone to become members. Maybe they're... And I guess I'm restating myself to it. Maybe it's possible that we can allow the village corporations to do as they choose independently and individually. Maybe there needs to be a new redistribution of the resources. Allow the village corporations to hold all the land that they have, both surface and subsurface, and maybe turn over a little bit of land to the regional corporations and let them play Monopoly or whatever. But we do need to look into all of the different possibilities. And Ralph mentioned some of these things and the jurisdictional issues that have developed from the years 1970 and throughout up until today, 1984, the issues of Public Law 280 and how they apply to Indian people as a jurisdictional issue. Also, the jurisdictional issues of under Public Law 280, the civil and criminal jurisdiction and taxation. And he also mentioned some of the accomplishments made in regards to fishing rights and also the recent movements and aggressive movements on the part of the IRAs to exercise governmental powers and to move away from the Secretary of Interior's approval over their constitutions and whatnot. These types of aggressive movements that are taking place, you know, to look at them against ANCSA, to look at them against all of the vehicles and all of the institutions that we have now. Also, Mr. Chamberlain mentioned, and David Case, there was discussion about the strategies, and I quite agree with Mr. Chamberlain that all of these strategies are inseparable. And a new accommodation needs to be found to encompass all of those strategies. A political institution, the control of the economic resources, the land and the resources, I can't recall all of the different strategies that were mentioned, but a vehicle in which to encompass all of these things and also to help clear up this overlapping of jurisdictions and what we found with the municipal corporations, the IRA governments, the traditional governments, the village corporations, the regional corporations. The picture looks pretty blurry right now. Maybe there's something entirely different, entirely fresh and new that we can come up with outside of all of the institutions that that have been created and that we've been working under. And maybe this isn't quite the forum to drag all of those possibilities out. There's going to be quite a bit of brainstorming that needs to be done and some real comprehensive and, again, intensive work in reviewing of all of these possibilities against the background of Indian law and the history of Indian law, the history and the experiences of Indian people throughout the United States, as well as such as this upcoming week, the international experiences. And it's going to take a lot of brainstorming. But these, you know, again, the 1991 issues, you know, they're to me the most pressing issues. All of this work has to be done simultaneously. We have to look at the short term. We have to look at the long term, and need to devise something that will assure us the things that we're so afraid of, and the the fears and the tension, the dissension, the disgruntlement of the initial settlement that we've received, you know, something new. And that's all I have to say. And I hope that we can come up with that. I mean, it may take at some point in time, I mean, as, and I don't know if it's a means of last resort or not, but to declare that there is a need for a jurisdictional settlement, that we want full restoration. Who knows?
Well, thank you, Daly. Thank you very much. I wonder if, before we move on, if Ralph Johnson and David Case and Kim Gottschalk and Alma Upixen would like to address the issues that Daly raised. In particular, is there anyone willing to answer her question? Were settlements in the past in the lower 48 made that related only to land, only to real estate, and failed, as it is suggested ANCSA did, failed to address the question of political institutions or native government? And in those cases, how did the native people concerned go about creating a governmental body for themselves? That was one question she raised that some of you might be willing to address.
Well, I might start. I'm sure that Ralph Johnson, that Kim Gottschalk and David Case can add to and maybe correct some of my data, but one of the most recent settlements was, well, there have been a series of things, and there's no consistency among the settlements that have occurred in the past 10 years. The Menominee Reservation, as you know, has been reconstituted, as Ada Deer has pointed out, with more or less full governmental powers. Some small tribes in western Washington and in western Oregon, what's the name of the Celeste tribe, was reconstituted a year ago. Again, is my understanding, with full governmental powers. Is that right, Ada? Yeah,
sure.
I think it was reestablished as a reservation with the same governmental powers as other reservations in the United States, with property that is Indian country under 18 U.S. Code 1151. The Lower Elwha tribe and some other small tribes in western Washington were reconstituted the same way. On the other, and I believe also the portion of Mount Adams and the Blue Lake Taos that were either allegedly mistaken surveys or other errors were put back into the reservation status and subjected to tribal governmental powers. On the other hand, you have the most significant land transaction, which concerned the Passamaquoddy and Penobscot tribes, the Maine Land Settlement Act, requiring the consent both of Congress and of the state of Maine, which essentially did not return to the tribes governmental powers, with the exception of some peripheral powers, one not really insignificant. They do have a governmental power, for example, under the Indian Child Welfare Act, but a fairly small segment of governmental power that was returned to the Passamaquoddy and Penobscot tribes. To my knowledge, the other negotiations for settlement for the eastern land claims are based more on land claim settlements, not on jurisdictional issues. As some of you well know, that has, in the case of the Maine land claim settlement, that has caused a great deal of anger, hard feelings. Some of the, if not most of, I can't tell you how many, but many of the Passamaquoddy and Penobscot tribes feel that they should have negotiated more for governmental power in addition to a land settlement. Whether that was achievable under the circumstances at the time, somebody else with a greater power of foresight and hindsight would have to comment on. But at least factually, that settlement was a major land settlement and only included a small portion of governmental powers. But it did recognize the issue. It did return to the tribes governmental powers over under the Indian Child Welfare Act. Right. Maybe David and Kim can say a lot more on those subjects.
David Case?
My
understanding, and it may be quite imperfect, is that really generally settlements and the settlement patterns in the past have focused on reservations, and that, and the jurisdictional aspect of the settlement is almost implicit in the establishment of the reservation, and it was very seldom, but relatively inexplicit in the terms of the treaties. Now, you know, the treaties will, especially the earlier treaties, will be more explicit about the reservation of governmental powers to tribes than the later ones, and I think that maybe is a reflection of the mental set of the treaty negotiators, which sort of assumed, in many cases, that these political institutions would not survive. But, of course, the interpretation of the treaties has been quite the opposite. The courts have always interpreted the treaties to reserve jurisdictional control in some significant measure to the tribe. Just the fact of the reservation itself is a federal preemption of conflicting jurisdiction with the state in many respects. So that's, I think, the pattern in the past, is reservation and jurisdictional settlements sort of being implied in one another in the process of making what is in fact a settlement of land claims with a mutual cession of Aboriginal title and the payment of some kind of compensation. And I cannot think of an example where there has been strictly a land claim settlement except for the very recent past, including the Claims Act. And so we end up, if that is true, in a unique situation, which makes it difficult to find models and examples to guide us by, you know, your new territory. But the example that does come to my mind, and it's sort of going at this all backwards, is Oklahoma, where there had been a past reservation of sorts, I mean reservation settlement, I think we can call it that, it's got the removal and everything else in its history, and a subsequent alleged termination of tribal political authority along with the opening up of the Oklahoma Territory and the establishment of the state of Oklahoma. And so you essentially, it seems to me, and my understanding of this is imperfect, so I had hoped that Browning Pipestem would be here, and that's why maybe we can address this more next week when he does come. But it's always seemed to me that essentially establishes the situation where you have tribes that have uncertain political power, undefined in many ways, or clouded because of the actions of the United States, political authority, and no clear reservation land base to attach it to. And that may be, and that's sort of the gray area, in my mind, of Indian country and jurisdiction. It's the dependent Indian community question of jurisdiction, and frankly, that's it. I mean, we are in an uncertain area in which the courts have not really defined what the scope of a tribe's authority would be in a non-reservation dependent Indian community, and so that gets back, finally, maybe to your question, what I thought to be one of the major thrusts of your talk was how far do you go in accepting the legal definitions of jurisdiction that are now the doctrines of federal Indian law? Do you work within them? Do you attempt to work some way beyond them? Do you do both? I don't know. But I guess the long and the short of it, of this sort of diffuse discussion, is that there are a few models, and that's one of the problems with talking about jurisdictional arrangements in Alaska today, because there are very few, if any, models from the past. And Oklahoma may be the best example, maybe the worst situation, but the best example of the kind of pattern that we now seem to have in Alaska.
Kim Gottschalk.
Well, I can only confirm what Mr. Case and Johnson have said, that there's a spectrum of situations ranging from tribes that obviously have fully recognized and developed jurisdictional rights and governing powers in which they give up a piece of land, and tribes who are unrecognized and have no land base and operate from that basis. And Alaska seems to me to at least be at the high bargaining end of the scale in terms of their vast resources to bargain strongly for. I don't even know if there's a need to bargain, maybe just demand jurisdictional rights.
Mr. Lerner? Oh, and then Joe Jorgensen, sorry.
Just a question for some information. Does any of these jurisdictions, whether village, borough, this whole complex series of layers of government, does any of them have the power to tax and license?
David Case?
Yeah, all of them do.
They?
Yes. So it's not complete, it's not absolute, there are always limits, but they do have the powers.
If the North Slope Borough wished to tax salaried incomes at a certain level?
As long as it has that delegated authority from the state, I don't think local governments have a delegated income tax authority in the state.
Okay. And under the federally chartered governments, might they do such a thing? I think
there's an inherent power to tax there, and there's no limit on it unless the Congress has limited it. See, it's sort of the reverse or the obverse of the local government.
Because they're not creatures of the state legislature.
They have inherent power, not delegated power.
Okay. And do they?
Yes.
Do they?
Do they actually tax income?
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, the people from the lower 40, none in Alaska do that. I
mean, in Alaska.
No, none of them, to my knowledge, no tribal governments in Alaska exercise an income taxing power. They do. They I think would have it, but they don't exercise it.
Okay. Thank you.
Daley Sambo, and then Joe Jorgensen.
It was just brought to my attention that maybe there has been a resolution of this jurisdictional issue, and I was asked to ask David Case that does Carlos versus Gustafson, the case, resolve that jurisdictional, some of the jurisdictional questions, and if so, how?
Carlo versus Gustafson. Right?
Okay.
Well, I don't think it resolved, we've resolved all the jurisdictional questions. I think it is very clear in this state that the state courts do not have proprietary jurisdiction over trust or restricted property. And that case involved a restricted townsite lot. That's really it's a federal case. The other cases that the state court has decided really seem to go further than that federal case and deny state court jurisdiction over the control of this property of restricted allotments or restricted townsite lots, which are the two kinds of restricted property we have in this state. Carlo versus Gustafson confirmed a trust responsibility on the part of the federal government to administer these townsite lots with a high degree of care. And that is a very recent case, 81 or 82. In my mind, it doesn't go so much to the state jurisdictional questions that seem to be talking about. But there are other state cases that do.
Joe Jorgensen.
Yeah, I think I need some clarification from Ralph Johnson, but as I read the statutes for the Maine Indian Claims Settlement Act, the act provided for the Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, and Maliseet, if they wish, to form governments. You can go ahead and do so. And that it provided a little bit more than Indian Child Welfare Act, that they would then have access to the Indian Self-Determination Act as well as to the Indian Education Act. And that at least says you can create a government, and now you have a vehicle through which you can cut from the BIA certain contracts and from the Indian Health Service certain contracts, and it provides a governmental floor that they hadn't had in the past in relation to the federal government.
That is true, and I was only using the Indian Child Welfare Act as one example, but it's my understanding, and I'm sorry John Stevens isn't here to give us an authoritative answer, that the Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, and other Malakeet don't have the power, for example, to levy taxes on either their members or non-members, don't have the power to adopt zoning laws that are binding on members or non-members, don't have the power to enact a criminal code, so that those aspects that we frequently think of as important aspects of jurisdiction were not returned to the tribes.
But they did state that PL 280 would apply. Is that a way that if there are these joint jurisdictions, that the tribe then could assume the power to control civil and criminal crime?
If they did say that PL 280...
Yeah, they did say that.
Well, PL 280, of course, cuts the other way.
Yes, I know.
Ostensibly, and that's... I guess at this point I'd have to say I'd have to look at the documents again to see, because I haven't made that close study of those.
One thing to perhaps put in about the Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Maliseet settlement is that it occurred after the Claims Act, and in some ways
after ANCSA,
and it did include some jurisdictional component, and that more or less highlights perhaps what Daly's point was, that the Claims Act did not include such a component. And that there is still a question of a jurisdictional settlement then in Alaska.
Well, can I raise one more point then? As I was trying to speak eventually to jurisdiction, many of the villages have nonprofit corporations that are IRA governments. If these are established, these IRA governments, although they don't have the authority that IRA governments have in the lower 48, the non-ANCSA governments, if there is to be a change, if you are asking for a large change from ANCSA, is it possible, because IRA governments have been established, to take back to them the authority for the control of land, as well as for the control of the economy, as well as for the control of the government, and then work with the issue of trust status of land?
Well, I don't think I would agree that the IRA governments do not have the same powers that tribes in the lower 48 have. There's nothing in the application of the IRA to Alaska that limits that authority. It limits in the terms of that law.
Governmental authority, how about the control of the economy? With the establishment, in the lower 48, the economies are controlled by the IRAs. There are some exceptions, such as Menominee, where they chose to separate the government from the business enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what I hear in the question then is, does the control of the land or lack of control of the land, how does that relate to the control of the economy?
Yes.
And it has a very significant, although uncertain, effect. And that is essentially the fact that there is no reservation. There's no unity of political and property ownership in Western terms authority. And that essentially cuts off one leg of the strategies that I had mentioned earlier. It makes it difficult to control economic enterprise, because the tribe doesn't have the ownership control in legal terms of the property. And so that gets to the question of trust lands in Alaska. The only thing that really can be said very persuasively is that it's confused, politically confused. And then there have been legal interpretations of political authority, which make it even more confusing, by the Interior Department's solicitor. Theoretically, well, you can argue that, more than theoretically, you can argue that the Claims Act itself does not prohibit the Secretary of the Interior from taking land in trust, and the IRA still applies in Alaska and still permits the Secretary to take land in trust. But the solicitor has interpreted the Claims Act to have just that effect,
right,
to prohibit the Secretary from using the IRA to take land in trust. And finally, the IRA, as originally applied to Alaska, included a separate reservation establishment provision. And interestingly enough, that provision was still on the books for 5 years after the Claims Act, but it was perhaps incidentally repealed in 1976 with the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, along with a whole bunch of other land withdrawal legislation. So you have that sort of pattern. You have the Claims Act, you have the subsequent repealed reservation authority under the IRA in Alaska, but you have the continuing reservation trust land authority under the IRA, and that's all still applicable.
So if we follow up Ralph Johnson the other day, there is a basis to make a rather large change, which is in fact just a series of small changes. It is conceivable that villages could be the possessors of the land, they could reestablish reservations, and that they could in some fashion have that land in trust. It may need not be in the Secretary, it may be under the Non-Intercourse Act even, but it's conceivable.
Oh yes, right. I mean, and, you know, you can sort of talk about it. We can spin this fine little web, or less fine little web of legal legalese here, but